Introductory remarks. Ladies and gentlemen, anybody who knows me will know what a big thrill it is for me to be here to introduce this band tonight. I've been a very, very great fan of Gary Brooker and Procol Harum ever since 30 years ago, when they suddenly surprised the world by leaping absolutely out of nowhere with one of the biggest hit records ever done by anybody at all, ever, under any circumstances. They then surprised the world even more by turning out to be from Southend and not from Detroit, as everybody thought. They then surprised the world even more by their complete failure to bring out an album within 4 months of the single on the grounds that they hadn't written it yet. And then, in a move of unparalleled marketing shrewdness and ingenuity, they also actually left A Whiter Shade of Pale off the album. They never did anything straightforwardly at all, as anyone who's ever tried to follow the chords of A Rum Tale will know. Now, they had one very, very particular effect on my life. It was a song they did, which I expect some of you here will know, called Grand Hotel. Whenever I'm writing, I tend to have music on in the background, and on this particular occasion, I had Grand Hotel on the record player. This song always used to interest me, because while Keith Reid's lyrics were all about this sort of beautiful hotel, the silver, the chandeliers, all those kinds of things, then suddenly, in the middle of the song, there was this huge orchestral climax that came out of nowhere and didn't seem to be about anything. I kept wondering, what was this huge thing happening in the background? And I eventually thought, it sounds as if there ought to be some sort of floor show going on. Something huge and extraordinary, like, well, like the end of the universe. And so that was where the idea for the restaurant at the end of the universe came from. From Grand Hotel. Anyway, enough from me. We're in for a great night tonight. There's no band quite like them. And tonight, I'm glad to say, the London Symphony Orchestra is going to sit in with them. So I'd like for you to welcome, please, the London Symphony Orchestra, the Chameleon Arts Chorus, Procol Harum, the conductor, the great Nicholas Dodd, and gentleman scholar musician, and I believe now also Rear Admiral Gary Brooker. Thank you very much. From a Procol Harum and London Symphony Orchestra concert, 1996. What is it we're all going to be trying to make next Saturday? Not New Year's resolutions, if we're halfway sane. They all fail so embarrassingly early into the new year that few of us are going to want to compound our sense of futility by making new millennium resolutions and having them fail, relatively speaking, 1,000 times earlier than usual. In fact, if I may digress for a moment, and if you don't want me to digress, then you may find that you are reading the wrong column, it turns out that there may be a very good reason why we fail to keep our New Year's resolutions, other than the obvious abject feebleness of will. It's this. We can't remember what they are. Simple. And if we actually wrote them down, then we probably can't remember where we put the piece of paper either. Oddly enough, the piece of paper has sometimes been known to turn up again exactly a year later when you're casting around for something on which to write the next year's abortive attempts to pull your life into some kind of shape. This is not, it turns out, a coincidence. Incidentally, am I alone in finding the expression, "it turns out," to be incredibly useful? It allows you to make swift, succinct, and authoritative connections between otherwise randomly unconnected statements without the trouble of explaining what your source or authority actually is. It's great. It's hugely better than its predecessors, "I read somewhere that," or the craven, "they say that," because it suggests not only that whatever flimsy bit of urban mythology you are passing on is actually based on brand new, groundbreaking research, but that it is research in which you yourself were intimately involved. But again, with no actual authority anywhere in sight. Anyway, where was I? It seems that the brain is affected by alcohol. Well, we know that, of course, and those who don't yet are about to find out. But there are different gradations to the effect, and herein lies the crux. The brain organizes its memories like a kind of hologram, it turns out. To retrieve an image, you have to recreate the exact conditions in which it was captured. In the case of a hologram, it's the lighting. In the case of the brain, it is, or can be, it turns out, the amount of alcohol sloshing around in it. Things that happen to you, or, frighteningly enough, that you yourself say or do while under the influence of alcohol, will only be recalled to your memory when you are under the influence of that exact same quantity of alcohol again. These memories are completely beyond the reach of your normal, sober mind, which is why, after some ill-advised evening out, you will be the only person who is completely unaware of some barkingly stupid remark you made to someone whose feelings you care about deeply, or even just a bit. It is only weeks, months, or, in the case of New Year's Eve, exactly a year later, that the occasion suddenly returns to your consciousness with a sickening whomp, and you realise why people have been avoiding you or meeting your eyes with a glassy stare for so long. This can often result in you saying, "Jesus God!" to yourself in a loud voice and reaching for a stiff drink, which leads you up to the next point of inebriation, where, of course, fresh shocks await your pleasure. And the same is true on the way back down. There are certain memories which will only be re-triggered by revisiting exactly the same state of dehydration as the one in which the original events occurred. Hence the New Year's resolution problem, which is that you never actually remember the resolutions you made, or even where you wrote them down, until the exact same moment the following year, when you are horribly reminded of your complete failure to stick by them for more than about 7 minutes. So what is the answer to this terrible, self-perpetuating problem? Well, obviously, rigorous self-discipline. A monastic adherence to a regime of steamed vegetables, plain water, long walks, regular workouts, early nights, early mornings, and probably some kind of fragrant oils or something. But seriously, the thing we are most going to want on New Year's Day, and be desperately trying to remember how to make, is a good hangover cure, and especially one that doesn't involve diving through the ice on the Serpentine. The trouble is, we can never remember them when we want them, or even know where to find them. And the reason we can never remember them when we want them is that we heard about them when we didn't actually need them, which isn't any help, for the reasons outlined above. Nauseating images involving egg yolks and Tabasco sauce swill through your brain, but you are not really in any fit state to organise your thoughts, which is why we need urgently to organise them now, while there is still time. So this is an appeal for good, effective methods of freshening up the brain on New Year's Day that don't involve actual cranial surgery. Hangover cures, please, therefore, to www.h2g2.com, and may the next 1,000 years be especially good ones for you and your descendants. The Independent on Sunday. My favourite tipples. I love whiskey in every way. I love the way it looks in the bottle, that rich golden colour. I love the labels arranged on the shelf, the kilts and the claymores and the slightly out-of-focus sheep. I love the sense that it's a drink that, unlike, for instance, vodka from Warrington, is rich in the culture and history of the place where it is distilled. I love particularly the smoky, peaty aromas of the single malts. In fact, the only thing I don't like about whiskey is that if I take the merest sip of the stuff, it sends a sharp pain from the back of my left eyeball down to the tip of my right elbow, and I begin to walk in a very special way, bumping into people and snarling at the furniture. I have, therefore, learnt to turn my attention to other tipples. Margaritas I'm very fond of, but they make me buy very stupid things. Whenever I've had a few margaritas, I always wake up in the morning with a sense of dread as to what I will find downstairs. The worst was a 6-foot-long pencil and a 2-foot-wide India rubber that I had shipped over from New York as a result of one injudicious binge. The confusing thing was that they arrived home several weeks after I did, so I found them downstairs one morning after having just had one glass of Chianti with my evening pizza. I therefore now drink Stolichnaya vodka martinis if I go to New York, because they're very smart and sophisticated and New Yorkery, but most importantly, they render me incapable of doing anything stupid, or indeed anything at all, though I occasionally converse very knowledgeably about quantum chromodynamics and pig farming when under their influence. I like Bloody Marys, but only ever have them in airports. I have no explanation for this. It never occurs to me to have a Bloody Mary in the normal course of events. But put me in an airport lounge, and I make for the Stolly and the tomato juice like a rat from a drainpipe, and arrive a few hours later at my destination, throbbing with jet lag. At home, I tend to drink whatever is lying around in the fridge, which is usually very little. My fridge has a peculiar feature. You put a bottle of good champagne in it, and when you come to look for it, you find a bottle of noxious, cheap white wine in its place. I still have not worked out how this happens. But I usually console myself with a glass of the world's most boring drink, but the only one I can drink with no ill effects whatsoever. A gin and tonic. Independent on Sunday. Radio Scripts Intro. I do enjoy having these little chats at the front of books. This is a complete lie, in fact. What actually happens is that you're battling away trying to finish or at least start a book you promised to deliver 7 months ago, and faxes start arriving asking you if you could possibly write yet another short little introduction to a book that you clearly remember writing the end to in about 1981. It won't, promises the fax, take you 2 minutes. Damn right it won't take you 2 minutes. It actually takes about 13 hours, and you miss another dinner party, and your wife won't speak to you, and the book gets so late that you start missing entire camping holidays in the Pyrenees, and your wife won't talk to you, particularly since the camping holiday was your idea and not hers, and she was only going on it because you wanted to, and now she has to go and do it by herself when you know perfectly well that she hates camping. So do I, incidentally. I'm making this bit up. And then more faxes come in demanding more introductions, this time for omnibus editions of books, each of which I have already written individual introductions to. After a while, I find I have written so many introductions that someone collects them all together and puts them in a book and asks me to write an introduction to it. So I miss another dinner party and also a scuba diving trip to the Azores, and I discover that the reason my wife isn't talking to me is that she is now, in fact, married to someone else. I am making this bit up as well, as far as I know. In the days when I used to be able to go to parties, in other words, in the days when I had only written a couple of books and the business of writing introductions to them had yet to become a full-time activity, it used to save a lot of time when you discovered that two of your friends didn't know each other, just to say to them, "This is Peter, this is Paula, why don't you introduce yourselves?" This usually worked fantastically well, and before you knew it, Peter and Paula would be a happy couple going off on joint skiing holidays in the French Alps with your wife and her second husband. So, dear reader, this is the anniversary reissue of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy radio scripts. Why don't you introduce yourselves? I have enjoyed this little chat. How should prospective writers go about becoming an author? First of all, realize that it's very hard, and that writing is a grueling and lonely business, and unless you are extremely lucky, badly paid as well. You had better really, really, really want to do it. Next, you have to write something. Unless you are committed to novel writing exclusively, I suggest that you start out writing for radio. It's still a relatively easy medium to get into because it pays so badly. But it is a great medium for writers because it relies so much on the imagination. You will learn a tremendous amount from it, and maybe get some useful exposure. Unfinished business of the century. Just a few more days to go. I think it's important not to leave a century, let alone a millennium, without cleaning up behind you, and there is clearly unfinished business to attend to. I suggest that the net community should try to identify this unfinished business and see if, between us, we can't get it squared away so that we can all enjoy the New Year celebrations with a sense of a century well done. But first, a word to the pedants. Yes, I know you all think that the millennium doesn't change till a year later, and very tedious you are about it too. In fact, you are so keen to have something you can wag your fingers at the rest of the world about that you are completely missing the point. It has no significance whatsoever. It is merely an excuse to go, "Whoa, look at that, there they go," as all the digits change. What other significance can it possibly have? 10, along with its multiples, is an arbitrary number. January the 1st is an arbitrary date. And if you happen to think that the birth of Jesus Christ is a significant moment, then all we can say with any certainty is that 1 AD isn't when it happened. Or 0 AD, if the previous year had been called that, which, as we all know, because the pedants keep banging on about it, it wasn't. Then, as the historians, a much more interesting bunch than the pedants, tell us, the calendar has been played around with so many times in the intervening years anyway that the whole thing is doubly meaningless. Consider this. We've only relatively recently got our time and date-keeping precisely defined and standardized with the aid of atomic clocks and such like. And on January the 1st, 2000, if the doomsayers are to be believed, all of our computer systems will go haywire and plunge us back in the Stone Age. Or not, as the case may be. So it seems to me that midnight on December 31st is the only solid and reliable point we have in the entire sorry mess. And so perhaps we should be celebrating that just a little bit. And instead of saying that we have got the end of the millennium or bimillennium wrong, we should say that our ancestors got the beginning of it wrong, and that we've only just sorted the mess out before starting a new mess of our own. Anyway, what the hell does it matter anyway? It's just an excuse for a party. But first, to unfinished business. One particularly niggling piece of unfinished business, it occurred to me the other day in the middle of a singing session with my 5-year-old daughter, is the lyrics to Do Re Mi from The Sound of Music. It doesn't exactly rank as a global crisis, but nevertheless, it brings me up short any time I hear it, and it shouldn't be that difficult to sort it out. But it is. Consider. Each line of the lyric takes the name of a note from the sol fa scale and gives its meaning. Do, a deer, a female deer. Re, a drop of golden sun, etc. All well and good so far. Me, a name I call myself. Fa, a long, long way to run. Fine. I'm not saying this is Keats exactly, but it's a perfectly good conceit, and it's working consistently. And here we go into the home stretch. So, a needle-pulling thread. Yes, good. La, a note to follow so. What? Excuse me? La, a note to follow so? What kind of lame excuse for a line is that? Well, it's obvious what kind of line it is. It's a placeholder. A placeholder is what a writer puts in when he can't think of the right line or idea just at the moment, but he'd better put in something and come back and fix it later. So I imagine that Oscar Hammerstein just bunged in a note to follow so and thought he'd have another look at it in the morning. Only when he came to have another look at it in the morning, he couldn't come up with anything better. Or the next morning. Come on, he must have thought. This is simple, isn't it? La, a something-something what? One can imagine rehearsals looming, recording dates. Maybe he'd be able to fix it on the day. Maybe one of the cast would come up with the answer. But no, no one manages to fix it. And gradually, a lame placeholder of a line became locked in place and is now formally part of the song, part of the movie, and so on. How difficult can it be? How about this for a suggestion? La, well, I can't think of one at the moment, but I think that if the whole world pulls together on this, we can crack it. And I think we shouldn't let the century end with such a major popular song in such an embarrassing state of disarray. What else? Well, what do you think? What are the things we really owe it to ourselves to sort out in the next few months, before the digits roll over and we all have a set of brand new, shiny 21st century problems to deal with? World hunger? Lord Lucan? Jimmy Hoffa? Where to put old 8-track tapes so that no one in the 21st century will ever have to see one ever again? Suggestions, please, and answers to www.h2g2.com. Independent on Sunday. The Dream Team. Dream film cast. Sean Connery as God, John Cleese as the Angel Gabriel, and Goldie Hawn as Mother Teresa's younger sister, Trudy. With a guest appearance by Bob Hoskins as Detective Inspector Phil Makepeace. Dream Rock Band. My absolute dream rock band no longer exists because their rhythm guitarist was shot. But I'd have their bass player because he is unquestionably the best. There may be more pyrotechnical players, but for sheer musicality, invention and drive, there's no one better than McCartney. He'd share vocals with Gary Brooker, the greatest soul voice of British rock and roll and a hell of a piano player. Two lead guitarists, they can take turns to play rhythm. Dave Gilmore, whom I've always wanted to hear play with Gary Brooker, because they share a taste for huge drama and soaring melody lines. And Robbie McIntosh, who is both a great blues rocker and an exquisite acoustic guitar picker. Drummer, Steve Gadd. Remember 50 Ways? By the time you've got a band this size, you more or less have to have Maestro Ray Cooper in it as well, on percussion. Though it would also be very tempting to include that incredible woman percussionist whose name I don't know from Van Morrison's band. Strings? Brass section? Royal Philharmonic? A New Orleans jazz band? For all that, you'd need synth wizard Paul Wicks Wickens. And a large truck. Dream Lover. The Dagenham Girl Pipers. With all due respect and love to my dear wife, there are some things that, however loving or tender your wife may be, only a large pipe band can give you. Dream Project. Given unlimited financial resources, I would love to fund a major research project into human origins, the transition from ape to man. A couple of years ago, I became fascinated by the aquatic ape hypothesis, the notion that our transitional ancestors spent a period in a semi-aquatic environment. I've heard the idea ridiculed many times, but never convincingly refuted, and I would love to discover the truth, one way or the other. Dream alternative careers. Zoologist? Rock musician? System software designer? Dream holiday. Intense scuba diving in Australia, out beyond the Great Barrier Reef to the wonderful clarity of the Coral Sea. Cod hole, shark diving, wreck diving, then to Western Australia to dive with enormous whale sharks, and finally to Shark Bay to dive with dolphins. Then I'd stop off for dinner in Hong Kong on the way home. Dream home. Something large and rambling on the beach somewhere, probably far north Queensland, with lots of wildlife around and high-bandwidth computer connections to the rest of the world. Also a boat and a pickup truck. Dream cuisine. If I was told I had to choose the cuisine of one country and eat only that for the rest of my life, I'd choose Japanese. Dream day out. I've already had this, in fact. It was 1968. A friend of mine and I took the day off school, went up to London and saw 2001 in Cinerama in the afternoon, and Simon and Garfunkel live at the Albert Hall in the evening. Where did you get the inspiration for your books? I tell myself I can't have another cup of coffee until I've thought of an idea. Intro for Comic Books, number one. People often ask me where I get my ideas from, sometimes as often as 87 times a day. This is a well-known hazard for writers, and the correct response to the question is first to breathe deeply, steady your heartbeat, fill your mind with peaceful, calming images of birdsong and buttercups in spring meadows, and then try to say, "Well, it's very interesting you ask that," before breaking down and starting to whimper uncontrollably. The fact is that I don't know where ideas come from, or even where to look for them. Nor does any writer. Well, this is not quite true, in fact. If you were writing a book on the mating habits of pigs, you'd probably pick up a few goodish ideas by hanging around a barnyard in a plastic mac. But if fiction is your line, then the only real answer is to drink way too much coffee and buy yourself a desk which doesn't collapse when you beat your head against it. I exaggerate, of course. That's my job. There are some specific ideas which I can remember exactly where they came from. At least I think I can. I may just be making it up. That also is my job. When I've got a big writing job to do, I will often listen to the same piece of music over and over again. Not while I'm doing the actual writing, of course, you need things to be pretty quiet for that, but while I'm fetching another cup of coffee or making toast or polishing my spectacles or trying to find more toner for the printer or changing my guitar strings or clearing away the coffee cups and toast crumbs from my desk or retiring to the bathroom to sit and think for half an hour. In other words, most of the day. The result is that a lot of my ideas come from songs. Well, one or two at least. To be absolutely accurate, there is just one idea that came from a song, but I keep the habit up just in case it works again, which it won't, but never mind. The idea for the restaurant at the end of the universe started with a track called Grand Hotel by Procol Harum. Most of the song describes the scene in an opulent restaurant. Silver, candlelight, chandeliers, etc. Then towards the end of the song there is a long orchestral section which builds to a huge climax for no readily apparent reason. I wondered what this climax was meant to signify. I had a bit of toast and thought about it. Well, I thought, it's probably just the universe coming to an end. So now you know how it's done. Simple, isn't it? Interview with Virgin Airlines, conducted by Claire Smith. If there's one man who should know a thing or two about travel, it has to be the guy who's eaten burger and fries in the restaurant at the end of the universe. We tracked down author Douglas Adams at his new home in the States, where he recently relocated for the filming of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I asked him, "What's your best childhood holiday memory?" My childhood holidays were pretty modest. The highlight was a fortnight in the Isle of Wight when I was about six. I remember catching what I was convinced was a plaice, though it was only the size of a postage stamp and promptly died when I tried to keep it as a pet. Have you been back there since you were a child? I've been back to the Isle of Wight about once. I stayed at a hotel where the evening's entertainment was to turn off the lights in the restaurant and watch as a family of badgers played on the lawn. Where did you go the first time you went on holiday without your parents? I hitchhiked round Europe when I was 18. What did you get up to? I went to Austria, Italy, Yugoslavia and Turkey, staying in youth hostels and campsites, and supplemented my diet by going on free tours around breweries. Istanbul was particularly wonderful, but I ended up with terrible food poisoning and had to return to England by train, sleeping in the corridor just next to the loo. Ah, magical times. Have you been back there since? I returned to Istanbul once. I was flying back from Australia and arbitrarily decided to stop off in Istanbul on the way back. But getting a taxi in from the airport and staying in a nice hotel instead of getting a ride in on the back of a truck and sleeping in the back room of a cheap boarding house somehow robbed it of its magic. I wandered around for a couple of days trying to avoid carpet sellers and then gave up. Where is the most remote or bizarre place you have ended up? Easter Island is, of course, the most remote place on Earth, famous for being further from anywhere than anywhere else is, which is why it is odd that I ended up there completely by accident and only for about an hour. I learned a very important lesson from this, which was, read your ticket. When were you there and why? I was flying from Santiago to Sydney, and was a bit tired, having spent the previous 2 weeks looking for fur seals, and didn't wake up to what the plane's itinerary was, till the pilot mentioned that we were just coming in for our one-hour stopover on Easter Island. There was a little fleet of minibuses at the airport, which whisks you away for a quick peek at the nearest statue, while the plane refuels. It was incredibly frustrating, because if I had been paying attention the day before, I could easily have changed my ticket and stayed over a couple of days. What's your favourite city? What fascinates you most about it? In my imagination, it's Florence. But that's only because of memories of travelling there as a student and spending days on end, blissed out on sun, cheap wine and art. Recent visits have overlaid those earlier memories with traffic jams and smog. Now I think I'd say that my favourite city is just a small town, Santa Fe in New Mexico. I love the high desert air, the margaritas and the guacamole, the silver belt buckles, and the sense that people sitting at the next table to you in the cafe are probably Nobel laureates. When was the last time you hitchhiked? About 10 years ago, on the island of Rodriguez, in the Indian Ocean. Hitchhiking was the only method of getting around the island. There was no public transport, but a couple of people owned Land Rovers, so you just had to hope they'd be passing. I ended up in a forest at dusk wearing shorts, but having left my mosquito repellent behind. As a result, I endured the most agonizing night of my life. Where was your favourite place when you were on the road of Last Chance to See? Madagascar, though in fact that was a kind of prelude to Last Chance to See. I love the forest and the lemurs and the warmth of the people. What do you consider the most interesting man-made structure in the galaxy? The dam they're building at the Three Gorges on the Yangtze, though perhaps baffling would be a better word. Dams almost never do what they were intended to do, but create devastation beyond belief, and yet we keep on building them, and I can't help but wonder why. I'm convinced that if we go back far enough in the history of the human species, we will find some beaver genes creeping in there somewhere. It's the only explanation which makes sense. Have you ever been there? I haven't been to the Yangtze since construction started. I never want to see the thing. And the most interesting natural structure? A giant 2,000-mile-long fish in orbit around Jupiter, according to a reliable report in the Weekly World News. The photograph was very convincing, and I'm only surprised that more reputable journals like New Scientist or even Just the Sun haven't followed up with more details. We should be told. If you were to name a place that looks like it's just been dropped from outer space, where would you think of? Fiordland in South Island, New Zealand. An impossible jumble of mountains, waterfalls, lakes and ice. The most extraordinary place I think I've ever seen. If you could go anywhere in the universe right now, where would you go? How would you get there? And who and what would you take with you? Locally, I think Europa, one of the 16 moons of Jupiter. It's one of the most mysterious bodies in the solar system, much beloved of science fiction writers because it's one of the few places that could possibly sustain life of some kind. And there are certain oddities in its structure which have led to wild speculations about it being artificial. Plus, on nights when the orbital alignments are right, you must get a great view of the fish. September the 22nd, 1999. Riding the rays. Every country is like a particular type of person. America is like a belligerent, adolescent boy. Canada is like an intelligent 35-year-old woman. Australia is like Jack Nicholson. It comes right up to you and laughs very hard in your face in a highly threatening and engaging manner. In fact, it's not so much a country as such, more a sort of thin crust of semi-demented civilization caked around the edge of a vast, raw wilderness full of heat and dust and hopping things. Tell most Australians that you like their country, and they will give a dry laugh and say, "Well, it's the last place left now, isn't it?" Which is the sort of worrying thing that Australians say. You don't quite know what they mean, but it worries you in case they're right. Just knowing that the place is lurking there on the other side of the world where we can't see it is oddly unsettling, and I'm always looking for excuses to go, even if only to keep an eye on it. I also happen to love it. Most of it I haven't even seen yet, but there's one place that I've long wanted to revisit, because I had some frustratingly unfinished business there. And just a few weeks ago, I suddenly found the excuse I'd been looking for. I was in England at the time, I could tell I was in England, because I was sitting in the rain under a wet blanket in a muddy field listening to some fucking orchestra in a kind of red tent playing hits from American movie soundtracks. Is there anywhere else in the world where people would do such a thing? Anywhere? Would they do it in Italy? Would they do it in Tierra del Fuego? Would they do it on Baffin Island? No. Even in Japan, where national pastimes include ripping out your own intestines with a knife, I think they would draw the line. In between the squalls of rain and trumpets, I fell into conversation with an engaging fellow who turned out to be my sister's next-door neighbour up there in Warwickshire, which was where the sodden field was. His name was Martin Pemberton, and he was an inventor and designer. Among the things he had invented or designed, he told me, were various crucial bits of tube trains, a wonderful new form of thinking toaster, and also a sub-bug. What, I asked politely, was a sub-bug? A sub-bug, he explained, was a jet-propelled underwater buggy sort of thing, a bit like the front half of a dolphin. You hold on to the rear, and it pulls you through the sea at depths of up to 30 feet. Remember that bit in the movie of Thunderball? A bit like those things. Great for exploring coral reefs. I'm not sure if that's exactly what he said. He may have said, azure sea, or limpid depths. Probably not. But that was the picture in my brain as I sat in the blustery rain watching an escaped umbrella totter past the bandstand. I had to try one. I said so to Martin. I may even have wrestled him to the ground and knelt on his windpipe. Everything was a bit of a blur, to be honest, but anyway, he said he would be delighted to let me try one. The question was where. I could try it anywhere, even just in the local swimming pool. No. The trick was to get to try it in Australia, on the Great Barrier Reef. I needed an angle, though, if I was going to get some hapless magazine to stump up a trip for me to try it, which, believe me, is the only way to travel. Then I remembered my unfinished business in Australia. There's an island I had visited briefly once 10 years ago in the Whitsundays at the southern end of the reef. It was a pretty dreadful place called Hayman Island. The island itself was beautiful, but the resort that had been built on it was not, and I had ended up there by mistake, exhausted, at the end of an author tour. I hated it. The brochure was spattered with words like international and superb and sophisticated, and what this meant was that they had Muzak pumped out of the palm trees and themed fancy dress parties every night. By day I would sit at a table by the pool, getting slowly sozzled on tequila sunrises and listening to the conversations at nearby tables, which seemed mostly to be about road accidents involving heavy goods vehicles. In the evening I would retire woozily to my room in order to avoid the sight of maddened, drunk Australians rampaging through the night in grass skirts or cowboy hats or whatever the theme of the evening was, while I watched Mad Max movies on the hotel video. These also featured a lot of road accidents, several of which involved heavy goods vehicles. I couldn't even find anything to read. The hotel shop only had 2 decent books, and I'd written both of them. On one occasion I talked to an Australian couple on the beach. I said, "Hello, my name is Douglas. Don't you hate the Muzak?" They said they didn't, as a matter of fact. They thought it was very nice and international and sophisticated. They lived on a sheep farm some 850 miles west of Brisbane, where all they ever heard, they said, was nothing. I said that must be very nice, and they said that it got rather boring after a while, and that a little light Muzak was balm to them. They refused to go along with my assertion that it was like having spam stuffed in your ears all day, and after a while the conversation petered out. I made my escape from Hayman Island and ended up on a scuba diving boat on Hook Reef, where I had the best week of my life, exploring the coral, diving with a wild variety of fish, dolphins, sharks, and even a minke whale. It was only after I had left Hayman Island that I heard of something really major that I had missed there. There was a bay tucked round on the other side called Manta Ray Bay that was full, as you might expect, of manta rays, huge, graceful, underwater flying carpets. One of the most beautiful animals in the world. The man who told me about it said that they were such placid and benign creatures that they would even allow people to ride on their backs under water. And I had missed it. For 10 years I fretted about this. Meanwhile, I had also heard that Hayman Island itself had changed out of all recognition. It had been bought up by the Australian airline Ansett, who had spent $1 squillion on ripping the Muzak out of the palm trees and transforming the resort into something that was not only international and superb and sophisticated and so on, but also breathtakingly expensive and, by all accounts, actually pretty good. So here, I thought, was the angle. I would write an article about taking a sub-bug all the way to Hayman Island, finding a friendly manta ray and doing, effectively, a comparative test drive. Now, any sane, rational person might say that that was a thoroughly stupid idea, and indeed a lot of them did. However, This is that article. A comparative test drive between an underwater, propeller-driven, blue and yellow, one-person sub-bug and a giant manta ray. Did it work out? Guess. The sheer, fatuous unreality of the idea struck me forcibly as we watched the huge, 40-kilogram silver box containing the sub-bug being wheeled across the tarmac at Hamilton Island Airport. There was, I realized, a huge difference between telling people in England that I was going to Australia to do a comparative test drive between a sub-bug and a manta ray, and telling people in Australia that I'd come to do a comparative test drive, etc. I suddenly felt like an extremely idiotic Englishman whom everyone would hate and despise and point at and snigger about and make fun of. My wife Jane calmly explained to me that I always became completely paranoid when I had jet lag, and why didn't I just have a drink and relax? Hamilton Island looks like a pretty good example of what not to do to a beautiful subtropical island on the edge of one of the great wonders of the natural world, which is to cover it with hideous high-rise junk architecture and sell beer and T-shirts and also picture postcards of how beautiful it used to be before all the postcard shops arrived. However, we would only be there for a few minutes. Sitting waiting for us at the jetty by the small airport was the Sun Goddess, which was the sort of glamorous, gleaming white boat that James Bond always seemed to spend an inordinate amount of time on, considering he was actually supposed to be a civil servant. It had been sent to meet guests going on to Hayman Island, and was the first indication of how much the place had changed. We were ushered graciously aboard. One attendant offered us glasses of champagne, while another stood guard by the sliding glass doors which led into the air-conditioned interior. His job was to push them open for us. He explained that this had become necessary because, unfortunately, the doors didn't open automatically when you approached them, and some of their Japanese visitors would often just stand in front of them for whole minutes, getting increasingly bewildered and panic-stricken, until someone slid them open by hand. The journey took about an hour, streaking effortlessly over the dark and gleaming sea under a brilliant sun. Smaller, lush green islands slid past us in the distance. I watched the long wake of water folding back into the sea behind us, sipped my champagne and thought of an old bridge that I knew in Sturminster Newton in Dorset. It still has a cast-iron notice bolted to it that warns anyone thinking of damaging or defacing the bridge in any way that the penalty is transportation to Australia. Now, Sturminster Newton is a lovely town, but it astonishes me that the bridge is still standing. Jane, who is much better at reading guidebooks than me, I always read them on the way back to see what I missed, and it's often quite a shock, discovered something wonderful in the book that she was reading. "Did I know," she asked, "that Brisbane was originally founded as a penal colony for convicts who committed new offences after they had arrived in Australia?" I spent a good half hour enjoying this single piece of information. It was wonderful. There we British sat, poor grey sodden creatures, huddling under our grey northern sky that seeped like a rancid dishcloth, busy sending those we wished to punish most severely to sit in bright sunlight on the coast of the Tasman Sea at the southern tip of the Great Barrier Reef and maybe do some surfing too. No wonder the Australians have a particular kind of smile that they reserve exclusively for use on the British. From offshore, Hayman Island looks deserted, just a large, verdant hill fringed with pale beaches set in a dark blue sea. Only from very close, too, can you spot the long, low hotel nestling among the palms. There is hardly anywhere you can get a good look at it from, since it is virtually smothered with what looks like giant feral pot plants. It snakes and winds its way through the greenery. Pillars, fountains, shaded plazas, sun decks, discreet little shops selling heart-stoppingly expensive little things with designer labels you'd have to carefully unpick, and indiscreetly large swimming pools. It was pretty fabulous. We adored it immediately. It was exactly the sort of place that 20 years ago I would have despised anybody for going to. One of the great things about growing older and getting things like freebie holidays is that you can finally get to do all those things that you used to despise other people for doing. Sitting around on a sun deck wearing sunglasses that cost about a year's student grant. Ordering up grotesque indulgences on room service. Being pampered and waited on hand and foot by, and get this, this is a very important and significant part of what happens to you on Hayman Island, staff who don't just say, "No worries," when you thank them for topping up your champagne glass. They actually say, "No worries at all." They truly and sincerely want you, specifically you, not just any old fat git lying around in a sun hat, but you personally, to feel that there is nothing in this best of all possible worlds that you have come to for you to concern yourself about in any way at all. Really. Really. We don't even despise you. Really. No worries at all. If only it were true. I had my sub-bug to worry about, of course. This huge great thing that I had lugged 10 times further than Moses had dragged the children of Israel just in order to see how it compared with a manta ray as a means of getting about underwater. It had been quietly removed from the boat in its huge silver-coloured box and discreetly stored at the dive centre where nobody could see it or guess at its purpose. The phone rang in our room. The room was extremely pleasant, incidentally. I'm sure you're keen to hear what the room was like, since we were staying in it at your expense. It was not enormous, but it was very comfortable and sunny and tastefully decorated in Californian pastels. Our favourite item was the balcony, which overlooked the sea because it had an awning which you lowered by pressing an electric switch. The switch had 2 settings. You could either turn it to auto, in which case the awning lowered itself whenever the sun came out, or you could set it to manuel, in which case, we assumed, a small, incompetent Spanish waiter came and did it for you. We thought this was terribly funny. We laughed and laughed and laughed and had another glass of champagne and then laughed some more, and then the phone rang. "We have your sub-bug," said a voice. "Ah, yes," I said. "Sub-bug. Thank you very much. Yes, is that all right?" "No worries," said the voice. "At all." "Ah, good. So, if you like, why don't you come down to the dive centre in the morning? We can check it out, see how it works, see what you need, take it out for a spin, whatever you want. We'll just do whatever we can to help you." "Oh, thank you. Thank you very much." "No worries at all." The voice was very friendly and reassuring. My jet-lag paranoia began to subside a little. We went and had dinner. The resort had 4 restaurants, and we chose the Oriental Seafood Restaurant. Seafood in Australia mostly seems to consist of barramundi, Moreton Bay bugs, and everything else. "Moreton Bay bugs," said our smiling Chinese waitress, "are like lobsters, only this big." She held her 2 forefingers about 3 inches apart. "We smash their head in. It's very nice. You will like." We didn't like that much, in fact. The restaurant was very smartly decorated in Japanese-style black and white, but the food looked better than it tasted, and they played muzak at us. For a moment I felt the ghost of the old Naff Hayman Island stalking through its glamorously tasteful new home. The other restaurants available were Polynesian, Italian, and the restaurant to which they gave top billing, La Fontaine, a French restaurant which we decided to keep for the last of our 4 nights, though we had nagging doubts. I tend to like local cooking, unless I'm in Wales, and the thought of French haute cuisine transported here did not fill me with confidence. I wanted to keep an open mind, though, because, as it happens, one of the best meals I ever had was steamed crab and chateaubriand of zebu, cooked by a French-trained chef in the south of Madagascar. But then the French had infested Madagascar for 75 years and bequeathed it a rich legacy of culinary skills and hideous bureaucracy. We decided at least to look at La Fontaine that night. As we prowled our way towards it, we traversed acres of beautifully laid carpet, past grand pianos, chandeliers, and reproduction Louis XVI furniture. I found myself racking my brains for any memory I might have of perhaps some schismatic 18th-century French court that might have been set up, however briefly, on the Great Barrier Reef. I asked Jane, who is an historian, and she assured me that I was being extremely silly, and so we went to bed. We were woken at precisely 7:30 the following morning, and indeed every morning, by a seagull which perched on our balcony and performed our regular early morning wake-up screech. After breakfast we went to the dive centre, which was about 1/2 mile from the hotel, and met Ian Green. It was Ian who had called the previous evening. He was in charge of all the diving stuff on Hayman, and a more helpful and friendly person would be hard to imagine. We got the sub-bug unpacked and examined it as it stood gleaming in the sun. It is, as I have said, shaped like the front half of a dolphin. The body of it is blue, and towards the front there are 2 small yellow fins, one on each side, which can rotate through a few degrees and direct the sub-bug upwards or downwards. At the back are 2 large handles, which you hold onto as the sub-bug pulls you through the water. Within reach of your thumbs are buttons which make the thing go and control its ascent and descent. Inside the bug is a cylinder of compressed air, a normal scuba cylinder, and this provides power to spin the 2 propellers which push the bug forward and also supplies air down a flexible tube to a free-floating regulator. A regulator is the thing you stick in your mouth which gives you your air when you're diving. The point of this arrangement is that you only need your mask and flippers. You don't need to carry a scuba tank on your own back, because you're getting your air direct from the sub-bug. The bug is designed in such a way that you can set a maximum depth beyond which it will not go. The very maximum, anyway, is 30 feet. Ian had received a flurry of faxes from Martin Pemberton about setting up the machine and was pretty confident about it. "No worries at all," he said, and asked me what I planned. I said it might be an idea to take it for a shallow local tryout before taking it out into deep water. "No worries," he said. I said that we could then take it with us on the proper diving expedition that was going out from the island the following morning. "No worries," he said. "So I will then spend a little time trying it out, getting used to it and putting it through its paces around the reef." "No worries," he said. "And then," I said, "for the purposes of this article I have to write, which is by way of being a sort of comparative test drive, I want to try the same thing on a manta ray." "No chance," he said. "No chance at all." I suppose I should have foreseen this. Or perhaps it was just as well that I hadn't foreseen it. If I had foreseen it, I wouldn't have been standing there half in a wetsuit looking out at the glittering Tasman Sea and thinking, "Oh, damn." I would have been sitting fiddling in my office in Islington, wondering if I'd done enough work yet to justify going out and getting a bun. The issue was very simple. As someone who has spent over 2 years working on ecological projects, the very first thing I should have realized was that you don't disturb the animals. It might have been all right to try and mount a manta ray 10 years ago, when first I heard about it, but not now. No way. You don't touch the reef. You don't take anything. No shells, no coral. You don't touch the fish, except maybe a few that it's okay to feed. And you certainly don't fuck about trying to ride manta rays. "Hardly any chance you'd be able to get near one anyway," said Ian. "They're very timid creatures. I guess some people have managed to get to ride on a ray in the past, but I would imagine it would be very difficult. But now we just can't allow it." No, I said, rather shamefacedly. "I understand. Believe me, I just really hadn't thought it through, I guess." "But we can go and have some fun with the sub-bug," said Ian. "No worries. We can take some pictures, too. That's a hell of a camera you've got there." We now come to another rather embarrassing part of the story, about which I have so far been extremely silent. Some very nice people at Nikon Cameras in England had lent me for this trip a brand new Nikonos AF-SR underwater autofocus camera, which is about £15,000 worth of the most sexy and desirable and fabulous camera equipment in the world. The camera is just wonderful, brilliant technology. Really? You want to take a photograph underwater? This is the perfect thing. It's an astonishing bit of kit. Why am I going on about it like this? Well, I spend a lot of time working on a computer. And because I am used to using a Macintosh, I hardly even bother to read manuals, and so I didn't really bother to read the manual for this camera. I realized that when I got the films back. Please, I really don't want to say any more, except to say thank you very much, Nikon. It really is an awesome camera, and I hope very much that you will let me borrow it again one day. I won't mention the camera again in this article. We took a small dinghy out to a tiny deserted island about 10 minutes away. Ian and I spent a happy hour or so pootling around with the bug. We dealt with a couple of problems, a grain of sand in a valve and so on. We worked out that the bug didn't work too well in very shallow water when it had to work against a tide. Well, we'd take it deeper tomorrow. Jane lay in the sun on the beach and read a book. After a while, we got back in the dinghy and went back to Hayman. Not much of a story in all that, I suppose, but the reason I mention it is that I remember it very vividly, and one of the shortcomings I sometimes feel of somewhere like, for instance, Islington, is the lack of any immediately accessible tiny islands that you can spend the afternoon pootling around with sub-bugs on. Just a bit of poignant thought, really. We don't even have any decent bridges you can deface. There were about 10 of us on the dive boat the following morning. The hotel is so spacious and rambling that you don't often get to see many of the other guests, but it was interesting to begin to realize how many of them were Japanese. Not only Japanese, but Japanese who held hands and gazed into each other's eyes a lot. Hayman, we discovered, was a major Japanese honeymoon destination. The sub-bug sat up on the back of the boat, and I sat looking at it as we made the hour's journey out to the reef. Hardly any of the Barrier Reef Islands are actually on the reef itself, except for Heron Island. You have to get there by boat. I was very excited. Apart from a couple of refresher dives in pools, this was my first proper scuba dive in years. I absolutely love it. I'm one of those people who has been tantalized by the flying dream for years, and scuba diving is the closest thing I know to flying. And for someone who is 6'5" and less sylph-like than, to pick a name at random, the Princess of Wales, the sensation of weightlessness is an ecstatic one. Also, I usually vomit on the way back, which is a good way of working up an appetite. We reached the reef, moored, got into our wetsuit gear, and prepared to dive. At low tide, the reef usually breaks the surface of the water. You can even walk on it, though that is now discouraged because of the damage it can cause. Even when the tide is high, though, reef diving is not a deep diving sport. Most of what there is to see lies in the upper 30 feet, and there's really any cause to go deeper than 60 feet. The very deepest a sports diver can go is about 90 feet, but there's really not a lot of point. You're usually looking at bare rock rather than coral at that depth, and Boyle's Law means that you use up your air much faster down there. Also, you have to spend much more time on the surface between dives if you're not going to get the bends. The sub-bug keeps you at a safe maximum depth of 30 feet. I wanted to do a regular dive first to get my bearings. Two at a time, we clamped our masks and regulators to our faces, did the big stride off the diving deck back of the boat, and dropped into the water in an eruption of bubbles. A moored dive boat always attracts the attention of a lot of local fish, who expect, usually rightly, that they will get fed. The ones you'll get to see if you're lucky are the Maori wrasses, which are extraordinary pale olive-green creatures about the size of a Samsonite suitcase. They have large, protuberant mouths and very heavy, protuberant brows. But the reason for the name Maori wrasse, any Australian will assure you apologetically, is because of some paint-like markings on their brow. Australians are not racists anymore. There were quite a few wrasses about the boat, and I made the mistake of getting between a couple of them and some pieces of bread that someone had thrown from the boat. The animals blithely barged past me to get at the food. I sank down to the reef in the huge space of water and light beneath the boat, and drifted easily round it for a while to get used to being underwater again, and then came back to the boat to divest myself of my scuba tank and collect the sub-bug. Together, Ian and I hauled it into the water. I got myself into position behind the thing and started it up. One of the curious features of scuba diving is that your suit and equipment seem so heavy and cumbersome and unwieldy on the surface, which is one of the things that tends to frighten beginners. But once you descend below the water level, everything begins to flow smoothly and easily, and the trick is to exert yourself absolutely as little as possible in order to conserve oxygen. It is almost, by definition, the least aerobic sport there is. It won't make you fit. At first, I was disappointed that the sub-bug wouldn't move me faster than I could swim. We were gently pulling our way down, but as I started to get used once more to the slowness with which everything happens underwater, I began to relish the long, slow, balletic curves it let you make through the water, stretched out at full length behind it, instead of swimming in the normal position with your arms by your side or on your chest. Following the contours of the reef became like skiing in ultra-slow motion, an almost zen-like idea. I began to enjoy it a lot, though after 15 minutes of experimenting with it, I began to feel I had exhausted its repertoire and began to look forward to swimming under my own power again. I suspect that it's probably a machine best suited to people who want to experience a dive, but don't want to bother with the business of learning to use buoyancy jackets and so on. I returned to the boat, and we hauled the thing back up out of the water. Well, I'd driven the sub-bug. But over lunch, I was worried about the total collapse of my absurd comparative test drive plan and discussed my thoughts with Ian and Jane. "I think we just have to think about the comparative test drive on a kind of conceptual basis," I said. "And we have to award some points. Obviously, the sub-bug wins some points for being portable, up to a point. You can take it on a plane, which you wouldn't do with a manta ray, or at least not with a manta ray we liked. And I think that we probably like all manta rays on principle, don't we? Your manta ray is going to be a lot faster and more manoeuvrable, and you don't need to change its tank every 20 minutes. But the big points that the sub-bug wins are for the fact that you can actually get on it. I think it has to get a lot of credit for that, if you're thinking of it as transport. But then let's turn the whole thing around again. The reason you can't actually ride a manta ray is a sound ecological one, and on just about every ecological criterion, the manta ray wins hands down. In fact, any form of transport that you can't actually use would be a major ecological benefit, don't you think?" Ian nodded understandingly. "Can I get on and read my book now, please?" said Jane. For the afternoon dive, Ian said he wanted to take me in a different direction from the boat. I asked him why, and he looked noncommittal. I followed him down into the water, and slowly we flippered our way across to a new part of the reef. When we reached it, the flat top of the reef was about 4 feet below the surface, and the sunlight dappled gently over the extraordinary shapes and colours of the brain coral, the antler coral, the sea ferns and anemones. The stuff you see beneath the water often seems like a wild parody of the stuff you see above it. I remember the thought I had when first I dived on the Barrier Reef years ago, which was this was all the stuff that people used to have on their mantelpieces in the 50s. It took me a while to rid myself of the notion that the reef was a load of kitsch. I've never learned the names of a lot of fish. I always swat them up on the boat and forget them a week later. But watching the breathtaking variety of shape and movement keeps me entranced for hours, or would do if the oxygen allowed. If I were not an atheist, I think I would have to be a Catholic, because if it wasn't the forces of natural selection that designed fish, it must have been an Italian. I was moving forward slowly in the shallows. A few feet in front of me, the reef gradually dipped down into a broad valley. The valley floor was wide and dark and flat. Ian was directing my attention towards it. I didn't know why. There seemed to be just an absence of interesting coral. And then, as I looked, the whole black floor of the valley slowly lifted upwards and started gently to waft its way away from us. As it moved, its edges were rippling softly, and I could see that underneath it was pure white. I was transfixed by the realization that what I was looking at was an 8-foot-wide giant manta ray. It banked away in a wide, sweeping turn in the deeper water. It seemed to be moving breathtakingly slowly, and I was desperate to keep up with it. I came down the side of the reef to follow it. Ian motioned me not to alarm the creature, but just move slowly. I had quickly realized that its size was deceptive, and it was moving much more swiftly than I realized. It banked again round the contour of the reef, and I began to see its shape more clearly. It was very roughly diamond-shaped. Its tail is not long, like a stingray's. The most extraordinary thing is its head. Where you would expect its head to be, it's almost as if something has taken a bite out of it instead. From the two forward points, the outer edges of the bite, if you see what I mean, depend two horns folded downwards. And on each of these horns is a single large black eye. As it moved, shimmering and undulating its giant wings, folding itself through the water, I felt that I was looking at the single most beautiful and unearthly thing I had ever seen in my life. Some people have described them as looking like living stealth bombers, but it is an evil image to apply to a creature so majestic, fluid, and benign. I followed it as it swam around the outside of the reef. I couldn't follow fast or well, but it was making such wide, sweeping turns that I only had to move relatively short distances round the reef to keep it in sight. Twice, even three times, it circled round the reef, and then at last it disappeared, and I thought I had lost it for good. I stopped and looked around. No, it had definitely gone. I was saddened but exhilarated with wonder at what I had seen. Then I became aware of a shadow moving on the sea floor at the periphery of my vision. I looked up, unprepared for what I then saw. The manta ray soared over the top of the reef above me, only this time it had two more in its wake behind it. Together the three vast creatures, moving in perfect, undulating harmony of line, as if following invisible roller coaster rails, sped off and away until they were lost at last in the darkening distance of the water. I was very quiet that evening as we packed the sub-bug back in its big silver box. I thanked Ian for finding the manta rays. I said I understood about not riding them. "Ah, no worries, mate," he said. "No worries at all." Written in 1992. Who are your favourite authors? Charles Dickens, Jane Austen, Kurt Vonnegut, P.G. Wodehouse, Ruth Rendell. Sunset at Blandings. This is P.G. Wodehouse's last and unfinished book. It is unfinished not just in the sense that it suddenly, heartbreakingly, for those of us who love this man and his work, stops in mid-flow, but in the more important sense that the text up to that point is also unfinished. A first draft for Wodehouse was a question of getting the essential ingredients of a story organized: its plot structure, its characters, their comings and goings, the mountains they climb and the cliffs they fall off. It is the next stage of writing, the relentless revising, refining, and polishing that turned his works into the marvels of language we know and love. When he was writing a book, he used to pin the pages in undulating waves around the wall of his workroom. Pages he felt were working well would be pinned up high, and those that still needed work would be lower down the wall. His aim was to get the entire manuscript up to the picture rail before he handed it in. Much of Sunset at Blandings would probably still have been obscured by the chairbacks. It was a work in progress. Much of the lines in it are just placeholders for what would come in later revisions, the dazzling images and conceits that would send the pages shooting up the walls. Will you, anyway, find much evidence of the great genius of Woodhouse here? Well, to be honest, no. Not just because it is an unfinished work in progress, but also because at the time of writing he was what can only be described as 93. At that age, I think you are entitled to have your best work behind you. In a way, Woodhouse was condemned by his extreme longevity. He was born the year that Darwin died and was still working well after the Beatles had split up, to end up playing Pierre Ménard to his own Cervantes. I'm not going to unravel that for you. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you should read Jorge Luis Borges' short story, Pierre Ménard, author of Quixote. It's only 6 pages long, and you'll be wanting to drop me a postcard to thank me for pointing it out to you. But you will want to read Sunset for completeness, and for that sense you get from its very unfinishedness of being suddenly and unexpectedly close to a master actually at work. A bit like seeing paint pots and scaffolding being carried in and out of the Sistine Chapel. Master? Great genius? Oh, yes. One of the most blissful joys of the English language is the fact that one of its greatest practitioners ever, one of the guys on the very top table of all, was a jokesmith. Though maybe it shouldn't be that big a surprise. Who else would be up there? Austin, of course, Dickens, and Chaucer. The only one who couldn't make a joke to save his life would be Shakespeare. Oh, come on, let's be frank and fearless for a moment. There's nothing worse than watching a certain kind of English actor valiantly trying to ham it up, as, for instance, Dogberry in Much Ado. It's desperate stuff. We even draw a veil over the whole buttock-clenching business by calling the comic device he employs in that instance malapropism, after Sheridan's character Mrs. Malaprop, who does exactly the same thing only funny in The Rivals. And it's no good saying it's something to do with the fact that Shakespeare was writing in the 16th century. What difference does that make? Chaucer had no difficulty being funny as hell way back in the 14th century, when the spelling was even worse. Maybe it's because our greatest writing genius was incapable of being funny that we have decided that being funny doesn't count. Which is tough on Woodhouse, as if he could have cared less, because his entire genius was for being funny, and being funny in such a sublime way as to put mere poetry in the shade. The precision with which he plays upon every aspect of a word's character simultaneously, its meaning, timbre, rhythm, the range of its idiomatic connections and flavours, would make Keats whistle. Keats would have been proud to have written, "The smile vanished from his face like breath off a razor blade," or of Honoria Glossop's laugh, that it sounded like cavalry on a tin bridge. Speaking of which, Shakespeare, when he wrote, "A man may smile and smile and be a villain," might have been at least as impressed by, "Many a man may look respectable, and yet be able to hide at will behind a spiral staircase." What Woodhouse writes is pure word music. It matters not one whit that he writes endless variations on a theme of pig kidnappings, lofty butlers, and ludicrous impostures. He is the greatest musician of the English language, and exploring variations of familiar material is what musicians do all day. In fact, what it's about seems to me to be wonderfully irrelevant. Beauty doesn't have to be about anything. What's a vase about? What's a sunset or a flower about? What, for that matter, is Mozart's 23rd piano concerto about? It is said that all art tends towards the condition of music, and music isn't about anything, unless it's not very good music. Film music is about something. The Dam Busters March is about something. A Bach fugue, on the other hand, is pure form, beauty, and playfulness. And I'm not sure that very much, in terms of human art and achievement, lies beyond a Bach fugue. Maybe the quantum electrodynamic theory of light. Maybe Uncle Fred flits by. I don't know. Evelyn Waugh, I think, compared Woodhouse's world to a pre-fall Eden, and it's true that in Blandings, Plum, if I may call him that, has managed to create and sustain an entirely innocent and benign paradise, a task which, we may recall, famously defeated Milton, who was probably trying too hard. Like Milton, Woodhouse reaches outside his paradise for the metaphors that will make it real for his readers. But where Milton reaches rather confusingly into the world of classical gods and heroes for his images, like a TV writer who only draws his references from other TV shows, Woodhouse is vividly real. She was standing scrutinizing the safe, and heaving gently, like a Welsh rarebit about to come to the height of its fever. The Duke's moustache was rising and falling like seaweed on an ebb tide. When it comes to making metaphors, well, all right, similes if you insist, you don't mess with the master. Of course, Woodhouse never burdened himself with the task of justifying the ways of God to man, but only of making man, for a few hours at a time, inextinguishably happy. Woodhouse better than Milton? Well, of course, it's an absurd comparison, but I know which one I'd keep in the balloon, and not just for his company, but for his art. We Woodhouse fans are very fond of phoning each other up with new discoveries. But we may do the great man a disservice when we pull out our favourite quotes in public, like, "Ice formed on the butler's upper slopes," or, "Like so many substantial Americans, he had married young and kept on marrying, springing from blonde to blonde, like the chamois of the Alps leaping from crag to crag." Or, here I go again, my current favourite, "He spun round with a sort of guilty bound, like an adagio dancer surprised while watering the cat's milk." Because, irreducibly wonderful though they are, by themselves they are a little like stuffed fish on a mantelpiece. You need to see them in action to get the full effect. There is not much in the Freddie Threepwood's isolated line, "I have here in this sack a few simple rats," to tell you that when you read it in context, you are at the pinnacle of one of the most sublime moments in all English literature. Shakespeare? Milton? Keats? How can I possibly mention the author of Pearls, Girls, and Monty Bodkin, and Pigs Have Wings in the same breath as these men? He's just not serious. He doesn't need to be serious. He's better than that. He's up in the stratosphere of what the human mind can do, above tragedy and strenuous thought, where you will find Bach, Mozart, Einstein, Feynman, and Louis Armstrong, in the realms of pure, creative playfulness. From the introduction, Sunset at Blandings. One or two Americans have asked me why it is that the English like tea so much, which never seems to them to be a very good drink. To understand, you have to make it properly. There is a very simple principle to the making of tea, and it's this. To get the proper flavour of tea, the water has to be boiling, not boiled, when it hits the tea leaves. If it's merely hot, then the tea will be insipid. That's why we English have these odd rituals, such as warming the teapot first, so as not to cause the boiling water to cool down too fast as it hits the pot. And that's why the American habit of bringing a teacup, a tea bag, and a pot of hot water to the table is merely the perfect way of making a thin, pale, watery cup of tea that nobody in their right mind would want to drink. The Americans are all mystified about why the English make such a big thing out of tea, because most Americans have never had a good cup of tea. That's why they don't understand. In fact, the truth of the matter is that most English people don't know how to make tea anymore either, and most people drink cheap instant coffee instead, which is a pity and gives Americans the impression that the English are just generally clueless about hot stimulants. So the best advice I can give to an American arriving in England is this. Go to Marks and Spencer and buy a packet of Earl Grey tea. Go back to where you're staying and boil a kettle of water. While it is coming to the boil, open the sealed packet and sniff. Careful, you may feel a bit dizzy, but this is in fact perfectly legal. When the kettle has boiled, pour a little of it into a teapot, swirl it around, and tip it out again. Put a couple, or three, depending on the size of the pot, of tea bags into the pot. If I was really trying to lead you into the path of righteousness, I would tell you to use free leaves rather than bags, but let's just take this in easy stages. Bring the kettle back to the boil, and then pour the boiling water as quickly as you can into the pot. Let it stand for 2 or 3 minutes, and then pour it into a cup. Some people will tell you that you shouldn't have milk with Earl Grey tea, just a slice of lemon. Screw them. I like it with milk. If you think you will like it with milk, then it's probably best to put some milk into the bottom of the cup before you pour in the tea. This is socially incorrect. The socially correct way of pouring tea is to put the milk in after the tea. Social correctness has traditionally had nothing whatever to do with reason, logic, or physics. In fact, in England, it is generally considered socially incorrect to know stuff or think about things. It's worth bearing this in mind when visiting. If you pour milk into a cup of hot tea, you will scald the milk. If you think you will prefer it with a slice of lemon, then, well, add a slice of lemon. Drink it. After a few moments, you will begin to think that the place you've come to isn't maybe quite so strange and crazy, after all. May the 12th, 1999.